Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. If you're going on vacation or a trip, you may have used websites such as Airbnb or Vacation Rentals by Owner to find lodgings. Not only are there more options through these sites, accommodations can be less expensive than hotels or properties booked through rental agencies. In Massachusetts, because they were defined as short-term rentals, owners were not required to collect room occupancy taxes. That all changed in December of 2018 when the Commonwealth passed a short-term rental tax assessed at the same rate as the traditional room occupancy tax. The legislation includes a number of provisions, and a little later in the hour, we're going to delve into the provision that creates a water protection trust fund for the Cape and Islands. But first, we ask Wendy Northcross, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber, to help us sort out the details of the short-term rental tax, and she joins us on the phone. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good. So before the passage of this legislation in December, what establishments were required to collect a room occupancy tax, and how much is that tax?
So essentially, every community in the Commonwealth has the option to add to what the state requires properties of hotels, motels, and if you're a bed and breakfast, if you have four or more bedrooms, then you have to collect an occupancy tax. The state portion is 5.7, but each municipality has the option of going up to 6% on top of that 5.7, so that the in essence, there was a much higher tax, but it would vary from town to town.
So what percentage is the short-term rental tax assessed?
So, new tax, who do they apply to? So the short-term rental tax essentially just modified the current occupancy tax law. And what it did was it included new types of properties that would be taxed, but they would be taxed at the exact same rate as hotel, motel, and bed and breakfast transactions. And that really is something that had been on our public policy radar screen for a long time because there was a disparity there, in our view. There was a growing disparity over time. But what we saw as equally similar transaction in a home rather than a hotel room was going untaxed. And I think the tipping point really came when the proliferation of these online rental platforms became so popular and so easy. What I saw, because we've been tracking this industry for decades, actually, at the Cape Cod Chamber, but tracking the Airbnb phenomenon, as it's called, although VRBO has a bigger market share on the Cape, tracking that, what we noticed were a couple of things. One is that the transaction now allowed for a per-night transaction. You know, historically, Cape Cod's had a second home that's rented out. Someone will rent their vacation home for the summer. They would rent the vacation home for a month. They would rent the vacation home for a week. And that was a coexistence with the hotels, the highly taxed hotels and motels and B&Bs that worked. But once we got into the online phenomenon and those overnight stays were being offered by the night, per night, that's when we saw a shift in market share. And it was essentially the same thing as building 100 new hotels on Cape Cod,
wow,
each with 100 rooms. So the amount of supply that was injected into the marketplace had a direct impact on our traditional hotel stock, and the playing field was becoming really imbalanced.
Yeah. So is anybody exempt from the short-term rental tax?
If you have a B&B of three bedrooms or less, there are some other nuances now because they've basically redefined what has to be taxed. If you, Mindy Todd, decide you're going to go on vacation, you want to go to the Grand Canyon for 2 weeks, and you decide, well, I'm going to rent my own home out while I'm away on vacation, you can rent your house for up to 2 weeks, 14 days, and not have to worry about any tax or any reporting or any of that phenomenon. What you do have to worry about, though, is if you rent your house out for 15 days, once you go over into that 15th day, the entire 15 days becomes taxable. You have to register your property. You have to collect the tax, and you have to submit it online by the 20th of the following month, which is actually not that difficult. It's what the hotels currently do. But so they have protected some of that smaller infrequent transaction. There's also certain things like lodging that's provided to seasonal employees. We don't have to worry about an occupancy tax for that. Employees of the U.S. military that are renting while they're on official orders, they don't have to pay the tax. So there's some exceptions to the rule that kind of have always been there. But I think the most prominent one is now you can rent your house on Airbnb for 14 days and you're don't have to worry about that.
Now, you mentioned that local tax on the room occupancy, the state's portion is 5.7%. So will the short-term rentals in the towns that also have that extra tax, will they have to collect that as well?
Yes. And there's been a little confusion on that. Some people think that the town has to go to town meeting and get a vote to apply the local option tax to this new short-term rental tax, but that's not the case. The town, if you're already on the record as applying a tax, and only four of the Cape Cod communities have gone up to the full 6%, the rest of them are at 4%. If your town has already been collecting that occupancy tax at that rate, it automatically applies to the short-term rental transaction. What we're finding now, though, and I think that you know your interviewees in the second half of the show can talk a little bit about that. Some of the towns are considering maybe we'll revisit that local option. Maybe it's going to be too much now. Maybe we can bring it down a little bit if we've widened the base of what's taxed. But that's a conversation that each community will or will not have. It's up to them to decide.
Now, as you were mentioning, a lot of these rentals and even the short-term rentals, they're done on websites or with flyers. So how is the state going to find all of these rentals to enforce this tax?
That's a great question. And we've actually been looking into software packages that exist. Once something's online, it's actually very easy to find. And I think that's been part of the concern that Airbnb has had with sheltering information, not making the full address of a property known online until you actually book the transaction. But, the towns will all have to figure out certain regulations for this new short-term phenomenon. But really and truly, if you've listed something either through your realtor, through your own doing on an online rental platform, it's easy enough to go out there and scrape up that data, throw it into a database. You can marry that up with the town's assessment information and see if a property is a primary residence, a second home, perhaps an investment property. And you can actually, get an indication whether that property has been rented or not from those online transactions and then go back in to enforce. So we've been looking and working with the county and potentially either purchasing or developing some software that would help the towns enforce that.
Are there any health or safety regulations for these short-term rentals as part of that state short-term rental tax?
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. I mean, I think that's why it took so long to achieve this kind of parity that the lodging industry has been asking for a while. So, you know, I had a hotelier in Yarmouth tell me one day that he had to get at least a dozen different permits and inspections to operate a hotel. The house rental market, not so much. I think the total is zero. So with this new transaction, or this new law, each community will now have to establish what they feel are fair regulations for the safe operation, for consumer protection. So each community now is going to have to figure out what they're going to ask those rental properties to provide, what inspections they'll need, what permits they'll have to pull. And that will take some time. And actually, according to the state law, those need to be in place by September of this year. So while you can do your short-term rental now, you kind of don't have to worry about those regulations until they're promulgated later this year.
The new short-term rental tax, as you're saying, also gives towns the option of levying a 3% impact fee. Is that correct? Optional impact fee for only for short-term rentals, or could towns collect, establish that pay the room occupancy fee as well?
Correct. This is something that actually Boston wanted, and again, one of the reasons I think it took a while to negotiate what the law was going to be in the end so they could pass something. The 3% community impact fee is written so that it will impact only those who own multiple short-term rental properties. and not the entire base of what who has to collect occupancy tax. So say you, Mindy Todd, have four or five homes in the Falmouth area that you rent out on a regular basis. Your community will know that. They'll look at the ownership and say, oh, Mindy Todd has five rental homes. You know, we're going to subject her to an additional community impact fee or not. Each community can decide this. Now, this community impact fee is another 3%, and of that, a portion of it has to be used for affordable housing or infrastructure. So infrastructure could be, you know, that we were trying to figure out for Provincetown, for example. They were kind of looking at that, and I was suggesting perhaps broadband could be considered infrastructure. Certainly wastewater, affordable housing is spelled out in the Act. So the problem that we have for Cape Cod, and the reason the Cape Cod Chamber doesn't specifically support that community impact fee, is it's another 3%. And what we have done, and part of your conversation today, what we have done for Cape Cod is we've gone the extra mile. We've said, okay, we are going to also, with the process of the short-term rental tax, assess a water protection trust fee. It's going to go into a special pot of funding that only Cape Cod towns can access so that Cape Cod communities can build wastewater infrastructure. And we'll get into that part of it because I think that's the next part of your show. But if you look at that, the 2.75% that is applied for this water protection trust, we feel the 2.75 on top of the existing occupancy tax, whether it's 11.7 or less, that's just a lot. You know, the Cape Cod Chamber actually invested in research while this whole debate was going on. Like, what's the consumer open to buy? How much will the consumer really pay in an occupancy tax before they put up their hands and say, no, that's too high. I'm not going to Massachusetts. I'm going to pick another destination. But we know from examples out there, New York City assessed a tax. It was close to 20%, and they started to see loss of business. So we don't want to be in that red zone. We feel that the Cape is still in a very, very competitive place with a 14.7% tax that we feel very confident that is not going to turn away business. But to layer another 3% on top of that, and maybe we've got a problem there. Yeah. So we don't want to go there just yet.
You mentioned that percentage that has to go to affordable housing or infrastructure projects. And I know on the Vineyard, some of the towns have talked about that as a means to address affordable housing. Have you heard of other towns here on the Cape that are looking at that? You mentioned Provincetown. Are there others that are talking about that?
To varying degrees, I think as they we're trying to help them understand it because, quite honestly, it's not well crafted in our view. So this additional 3% assessed on a property owner with multiple properties, it's very easy to create limited liability corporations for every single one of your five houses, Mindy, that you then sidestep that, well, see, they all have different ownership. Mm-hmm. It's not the same. I'm not the same owner. So it's really rather straightforward for property owners to kind of sidestep that if they wanted to. And I don't think it's the best place for a community to be at the moment, putting their eggs in that basket. We have heard some towns discussing potentially, well, maybe we will back out of this water protection trust and go and pursue that 3% community impact fee. We're getting a little geeky here with this stuff now. But to do that, we feel would be cutting off your nose to spite your face. That 3%, again, is on a much smaller base of what's potentially rentable in your community versus this 2.75, which is applied to every transaction. The entire base must look at and collect a water protection trust fee. So there's nuances to the towns why they might be thinking about that, but I think truly, and one of the reasons that we know this rental tax was passed with great leadership from our Cape and Islands delegation, not easy votes to take to create new taxes, but we know every single town on Cape Cod needs new revenue. They need more revenue for, well, fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the needs for Cape Cod? Certainly wastewater at the top of it, but now they have new local revenue coming into town, and we actually need to give this some time to figure out just how much. That's a frequently asked question to me. You know, town managers will call, well, how much do you think this is going to generate for our town? It's like, hard to say. We're going to have to really see who maybe pulls out of the marketplace because they don't want to be bothered collecting a tax, how it's, you know, what the business cycle is like. And because of the way the law is written and certain things phase in, I think it's going to take a good year and a half to 2 years to sort of normalize and understand just how much local revenue is really going to be generated by the short-term rental tax. My back-of-the-envelope sketch for the entire Cape is we will double the amount of rooms tax that's collected today. So we'll probably be in the total bucket around, we collect around $26 million. We think that will double, so over $50 million.
So when will people have to start collecting the short-term rental tax and the water protection fund tax? When does that begin?
That's a great question. And there was a lot of, I don't want to say confusion, but people were hearing this short-term rental tax, and they didn't think part of it applied to them, the traditional hotel, motel, and B&Bs that have been collecting occupancy tax for decades. But in fact, they do. So as of July 1st, for any overnight stay on or after July 1st, you have to begin assessing this fee, either to your short-term rental or to your hotel, motel, and B&B. The 2.75 Water Protection Trust Fund will be collected as of July 1st, unless the contract, the reservation, was made before January of this year. Mm. So the legislature, of course, didn't pass this law until the 28th of December, and they just said it's just not fair to be assessing something. Well, we give people some time. If once the law was passed, now you have fair notice, we'll give you 6 months. And so that, in fact, is the case. So as of July 1st, on or after July 1st, unless the reservation or contract was signed before January of 2019.
So are you providing your members with assistance on how to explain the new taxes to guests?
In fact, we are. And it's our hope that we can create some kind of a piece that's actually handed to folks at the desk, either upon check-in or check-out. Perhaps there's something in the hotel rooms. But really and truly, we want people to know that a part of their vacation stay is going to help protect Cape Cod water, that we care about our environment, that we're taking extraordinary means and spending billions of dollars to do right by Cape Cod's bays and estuaries, take care of our shellfish, our finfish, and our human beings, and make sure that our water is clean and healthy, and that Cape Cod continues to be a great place to vacation and to live.
We'll put a link to the Mass government page with the more information about the short-term rental tax at our website, capeandislands.org. Wendy Northcross, thanks so much for taking time to explain this all to us.
Thanks, Mindy.
Coming up after break, we discuss the formation of the Cape and Islands Water Protection Trust Fund. You're listening to The Point. We now turn to a provision of the short-term rental tax passed in December of 2018, the establishment of the Cape and Islands Water Protection Trust Fund. Joining us to talk about how this trust fund will be administered and what projects it will help fund is Christy Senatore, Executive Director of the Cape Cod Commission. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Andrew Gottlieb, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so as we heard from Wendy, short-term rentals and any establishment already required to collect the room occupancy tax has to collect a 2.75% surcharge that goes into the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund. And we should mention this provision only applies to the Cape and Islands towns. Not all towns in the Commonwealth have to collect this surcharge. So, Christy, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the Water Protection Fund, remind us of the lawsuit the Conservation Law Foundation brought against the EPA over the Cape and Islands wastewater problem and what's come out of that.
So as a result of that lawsuit, the Cape Cod Commission was directed to update what's called our 208 plan. So this refers to Section 208 of the Federal Clean Water Act. And we were directed to update the plan from 1978 to address 21st century problems, really nitrogen in our marine embayments and estuaries. So we drafted that plan, and it was approved by both the EPA and DEP in 2015. And that really lays out a roadmap for Cape communities to address the wastewater problems that we're facing.
What are the key provisions of the 208 plan that will guide towns on addressing wastewater issues?
We took an approach that really looked at shared watersheds. 2/3 of the watersheds that are on the Cape actually cross municipal boundaries. So in order to address the problem, we really needed to look at that from a regional perspective and looking at communities working together to solve the wastewater issue. As they're looking to create solutions, it makes sense for them to talk to their neighboring communities. It was a lot of community outreach as we established that plan. And one of the major components of that plan was really putting all the technologies on the table. So there is certainly more available than just traditional sewering options. So the technologies matrix that was created as a result of this plan really outlines availability of technologies that can be used to address the problem on the Cape.
So what watersheds have been identified as a high priority?
Mostly the watersheds that are significantly impaired have been identified as higher priority watersheds. And certainly a lot of communities are making progress and they're moving forward with solutions to clean up those estuaries and embayments. And we're really looking to make sure that those communities that are making progress, that are working with their neighboring communities, are considered priority watersheds and can be in line for appropriate permitting, whether it's through the Cape Cod Commission or DEP.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, you've been working on this issue for a really long time now. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about, how big a problem this is. I mean, what you're seeing, and as Chris was saying, some towns have approached this, with a little more emphasis than others, And the watersheds cross town lines.
Yeah, I mean, this is truly a Cape-wide problem. It's worst in the south-facing embayments and then also on the west side around, facing Buzzards Bay, just because of a combination of physical factors, the size of the water bodies, the relatively low tidal exchange, and the relatively heavy development around those water bodies. The north side of the Cape, a little less so. The estuaries are formed a little bit differently. There's much greater tidal exchange. There's a little less development pressure. But there is no significant embayment on Cape Cod that is not already either impaired or threatened. And so, we look at this as the single greatest water quality challenge that Cape Cod has. And every town has a piece of the pie and a piece of the problem and some degree of responsibility. And as you mentioned, some are at it more aggressively than others. I think that one of the significant changes over the course of time that I've been working on it, and you rightly point out it's been a long time, is that I think every town understands and accepts that this is an issue. They have some responsibility and some incentive to deal with. This is not just an environmental problem. This is its underlying core, an economic problem for Cape Cod. And so you don't have what we had when this conversation first really became one that was routinely in the public arena. A lot of people saying or questioning the science or saying it really isn't a big deal. I think everybody accepts it's a big deal. The biggest problem remaining is it's an expensive deal. And Christie's organization, the commission, did great work in coming up with an alternative method through the 208 plan to look at it that, in addition to bringing some thoughtfulness to the discussion, also significantly lowered the price by mixing in alternatives and intertown cooperation. But at the end of the day, how you're going to pay for it remains the single greatest impediment to actually making progress.
Yeah. And I think it's hard sometimes for people to really understand the scope of the problem. And I just am thinking this was, I want to say at least a decade ago, maybe even more. Buzzards Bay Coalition had done this map of the eelgrass. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Where it showed what the eelgrass was. I can't remember, 20 years before, whatever before, and then how much it had changed. And it was dramatic when you look at that. I keep saying they need to do that again, update it again, because visuals like that, I think, help people really understand how big this problem is. And that's, they hear how much it's going to cost. And I think sometimes just the towns are on board, but I wonder if it's a harder sell for individuals.
Well, I think that, it's a challenge. And one of the challenges that we face and one of the reasons why this short-term rental tax and the creation of the trust fund is of such huge significance is up until that law went into effect around the first of the year, the totality, basically, of solving this problem was on the property tax back of the 215,000 year-round residents. And even with the dramatic cost reductions that the commission unlocked with the 208 plan, the individual cost per household was still very high. And one of the least talked about but most important elements of the 208 plan was the concept of a cost share, whereby it identified significant obligations to the state and federal government to help Cape Cod with the unique problems that we confront. And the short-term rental tax is really the delivery of the property tax relief that the commission's plan called for 5 years ago when it was put out.
All right. So the Water Protection Trust Fund, do we have any estimates of how much money the trust fund will collect annually? Do we have any idea?
The, you know, using the estimates that Wendy referenced in her in the previous segment, you know, the Water Protection Trust Fund can be expected to take in somewhere around half of what the overall local share of revenue will be. And you know, Wendy suggested that somewhere in the order of $50 million. As we were talking about this through the legislature, we're looking at it providing around $20 million a year, which is about a cost of the over about a quarter of the cost of the overall wastewater implementation program across the Cape. It's a big number and a big benefit to property taxpayers.
Estimated to cost, what, $4 billion to clean up the watersheds in our region? So the tax alone isn't going to be enough money to cover that entire cost. What's the vision for how money in the trust fund will be used?
The idea behind the trust fund and the structure of the trust fund was the state runs an existing loan program for municipalities across the Commonwealth called the State Revolving Loan Fund. And there's an objective scoring process that towns who want assistance in wastewater projects goes through annually to get selected on a funding list. Being on that state funding list is a threshold requirement in order to access the additional money that comes through the Cape and Islands Trust Fund. And basically what it does is you can get a zero interest loan from the state right now for wastewater projects that address significant nutrient problems. The Cape and Islands Trust Fund will pay off a portion of the debt that you incur from to the state for a project that gets funded on the list. Ideally, again, across the region, we anticipate that it'll pay for about 25% of the loan cost. So if you have a $10 million project, Cape Towns have the ability to get a zero interest loan, which is not available to regions, to projects throughout the Commonwealth. It's really directed as a special program, limited almost exclusively to Cape Cod towns. So you get $10 million loan, you pay no interest on it, and now with the advent of the Cape and Islands Trust Fund, you might potentially only pay back $7.5 million of $10 million loan. So it's a very lucrative deal.
Just the Cape Towns, or does it include the islands?
The islands are complicated. The islands, when the law passed, when the governor signed it, all 15 Barnstable County towns were included by statute with no further action required by them to remain in good standing under the Act. It provided the ability for Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and I'm reminded Gosnold, to opt in upon seeking approval from DEP of either their own 208 plan or something that DEP would determine to be a suitable equivalent. So the ability of the islands to get in is clear. It needs to be initiated by the island communities. And so right now, absent that action having been taken, the 2.75% surtax that applies to all stays does not apply in the islands, nor do the islands have the ability to access money from the trust fund.
Christy, what's been in coming up with their own 208 plan? Have the islands talked to the Cape Cod Commission at all about what work's been done at the commission? Or
they certainly have, and we've been coordinating with the Martha's Vineyard Commission on certainly how they can move forward with some type of a suitable equivalent or a 208 plan. So they've got very similar issues with dealing with wastewater on the Cape, so there's a lot of information sharing that can be had.
What about Nantucket?
And Nantucket as well. We've been in coordination with their with the town administration over on Nantucket and look to share some lessons learned.
Yeah. So how is this money going to be allocated? I mean, who's going to figure out who's going to get how much? How's that going to be determined?
So that's been the subject of a lot of conversation and
sure.
Some consternation. The part of the efficiency in creating the trust fund, as I mentioned, was not adding an additional selection process. We piggyback on the existing state revolving fund program. The administration of the funds, the actual banker in this instance, is the state treasurer's office, who administers the money part of the loan program, so out of the Clean Water Trust. The disbursement of money from the Cape and Islands Trust is subject to some limitation and oversight by a management board that is comprised of representatives of each one of the 15 Cape towns. In addition, the commission, Cape Cod Commission and the Martha's Vineyard Commission serve as ex officio members. And any allocation of money out of the trust fund from the treasurer's office has to be approved by the by that local board. And it's a way to make sure that it's not substituting for money that would otherwise have been spent on the Cape, but it's additional and incremental. The second part of it is that the management board has responsibility for ensuring the equitable distribution of funds from the trust to the member communities. And that term equitable distribution has been subject of a lot of conversation. What I can offer you is my opinion only. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it will be the management board that determines what's equitable and what's fair. But to bound the discussion, the Commission's 208 plan has a 50-year implementation horizon. And towns, even the most best-intentioned towns that have an overall comprehensive plan, implement their program in phases. So they'll come do phase one in year one and go get an SRF state loan for that. And then they got to build the thing out, get it working, and then they go to phase two. And that might be 3, 4, 5 years down the road. It might be longer. And so the staggering of projects creates both an opportunity and a challenge for the management board to determine, well, what's equitable? Mm. My view is that the communities and the region are best served by making sure that there's sufficient money in that trust fund to provide a substantial and equal portion of subsidy to towns as they move through the process, and that we shouldn't get hung up on year-to-year disbursements to towns. Because it's really important for the money, more important for the money to be there when the project is being financed as opposed to being allocated out. An additional complication to that is the sole mechanism for accessing money under the trust fund is to subsidize a loan. If your community isn't asking for a loan because it doesn't have a project that's going to construction in a particular year, there's no mechanism to take money out. Mm. And so what I'd like to see happen is that, you know, we determine once we have a better handle on how much money is going to come in, what the percentage rate we can subsidize each community's project when that project comes in. Over time, to the extent we're implementing the plan and the community projects are consistent with the plan, they have to be. They have to get Christie's assurance that they do meet with the 208 plan. It'll all come out in the wash. Mm. And I think that overall what it would do is provide enough assurance to communities that when their project comes forward, there's an additional source of payback that doesn't rely on property taxes.
You mentioned that there's going to be a member from each town, all 15 towns. Have these people been chosen yet? Who are these people on the management board?
So the management board are members that are appointed by the Board of Selectmen or Town Council. In the case of Barnstable, it can either be a town manager or town administrator, a member of the Board of Selectmen, or a professional staffer from each of the 15 communities. And then, as Andrew mentioned, both the Martha's Vineyard Commission and the Cape Cod Commission directors will serve as ex officio members. So we'll be responsible for convening that board in the next coming months.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the short-term rental tax passed in December of 2018 and the establishment of the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund. And with us is Christie Senatori, Executive Director of the Cape Cod Commission, and Andrew Gottlieb, Executive Director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email from Mike who says, can you provide an example of a project and what's involved in cleaning up an estuary? I think a brief idea of the science and the actual physical work involved will help people relate better.
Well, you know, the underlying science is that when we put our waste in the ground, There's an amount of nitrogen that comes through the waste, it travels through the groundwater, and it discharges into the embayment, either directly out from the groundwater or through a river discharge. And basically, you're over-fertilizing the water body. And so the challenge here is to either, through source control, stop putting as much nitrogen into the ground. And the traditional technologies, and the, you know, the most reliable in that regard, is just conventional sewering, where you're connecting a pipe to the individual homes, gathering up all that wastewater through a collection system, bringing it to a central treatment plant, treating it to a very high level, and discharging it most often into the ground, but with much less nitrogen in it. There are additional systems that are improvements on existing Title V backyard septic systems that allow for on-site treatment, but at a higher level of treatment. Those are commonplace. And then the other alternatives to source control, which are the typical loan projects you get a loan for because they're long-time assets. They have a long lifetime, and you can finance them over a lengthy period of time. But there are other approaches that deal with the nitrogen that's already in the groundwater, that which continues to be discharged. A lot of towns are making big investments in aquaculture. And the shellfish propagation programs have the ability to not take nitrogen directly out of the water, but the clams and oysters filter the water that has the algae, that has the nitrogen in it. When you harvest the animal out of the water body, you take the nitrogen out with you. There are dredging projects that have some limited applicability. There are some inlet widening projects to restore the natural width before sometimes we narrow them down with roads and bridge abutments. There are reactive barriers. There's a number of different technologies, but the single biggest and most expensive component of all this is the collection treatment plant and disposal beds.
And I would just add, we have a technologies matrix that I referred to earlier, and we're constantly looking for better and new information around some of these traditional and also non-traditional technologies so that we can find the most innovative solutions that are the most efficient, but also decrease some of the costs that we're talking about today.
Yeah. And you mentioned sewer, Andrew, and Christian, we probably get this a lot. People go, well, we can't sewer the entire Cape. And that's right. So as part of the plan, have you identified what areas, you know, would best benefit by being sewered?
Absolutely. We won't be sewering the entire Cape. That was never part of the plan. But there are areas where sewer would be appropriate, and those areas where there may be increased density opportunities. And if we're looking to address our housing issues that we know are integrated with our wastewater issues, there will be opportunities for traditional sewer in some areas across the Cape, these centers of activity where we have dense development already. The fewer users on the length of pipe, the lesser the cost will be.
Yeah. The other thing is there's an opportunity for the two things to work in tandem. So you've got a project, an alternative project in Falmouth, the Bourne's Pond Inlet opening, which would restore the natural width of that opening to Nantucket Sound from 50 feet, which is what the bridge abutment provides, back to 100 feet roughly there. That would be what naturally, and the increased amount of flow in there is actually projected to lower the amount of, significantly, the amount of sewering that would be needed around Bourne's Pond. So it's a cheaper way for Falmouth, in this example, to solve its problem by marrying those two approaches.
Yeah. Let's talk to Eileen, who's giving us a call from Chatham. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Listen, we've lived in Chatham, South Chatham, for 21 years. So we've been watching our waste treatment progress as it's come along. And I think it was about, they're sewering more of towns. And we did have sewers in certain parts of town before we moved there. I called the, you know, entity that controls this about 6 or 7 years ago. And at that time I said, yeah, where do you think we will stand? You know, how long would it take to get to us? Because we are for it. And, at the time, he said, probably 10 years. Okay. So recently I called to get an update to see where we were on the list. And, well, you're not on the list. I said, well, what happened? Well, he said, as you know, Chatham is allowing a hookup with Harwich to help them. I said, well, you know, Chatham did step up to the plate or bite the bullet or whatever kind of phrase you want to use. And now we have no idea when that's going to happen. And, you know, is that common that we can just take a gigantic, enormous plan that we all, you know, not all of us agreed to, but many, and we enacted a financial plan for it and everything, and now we have no idea if we'll ever live to see that.
That's a good question, Lee. I actually had a similar question in my mind when I was thinking. I also have had sewer put in on you know where I live, and a lot of the side roads that actually go down to the water, some of them got sewered and some of them did not. And I'm thinking, is it just a matter of time? Is there a plan that those that are closer to the water will also be unsewered? To Eileen's point, she wants it, but isn't able to get it. So is that pretty common that a plan changes like that?
You know, as I mentioned, these plans are, in most instances, 25 or even longer year plans with different elements to them and different rollouts. And one of the underpinnings of the 208 program was the concept of municipal control, that there would not be some central authority making these connection decisions and deciding where the sewer lines go, and it was going to be left up to the individual towns. And as with many things, you leave it up to the towns. There's, you know, changes in plans, changes in priorities. And, you know, I know that there were circumstances at one time when Chatham was thinking initially about doing his program, they were going to do the entire town. And I think as they've done some of their phasing, they realized that for water quality purposes, doing some collection and treatment in the town of Harwich has a bigger bang for the buck in terms of water quality return than some of their other phases. So I know they move things around, you know, but at the end of the day, these decisions are made by individual municipal officials, and that provides each one of us who lives in our town the opportunity to go speak to our governing boards in our individual communities and have your say. It's have your say at town meeting, and ultimately the town decides where it's going to put the sewer.
Go ahead.
Well, and Eileen raised a great point that the town of Chatham is working with the town of Harwich, and so we're seeing collaboration, those two communities working together to create more efficiencies. We're also seeing the four communities around the Pleasant Bay watershed working towards a solution. They've already have a watershed permit through the Department of Environmental Protection and 208 consistency review, and they're really working together to not only take their four plans, but make sure that there's areas and opportunities for efficiencies as they move forward to implement solutions that cost less for their communities.
Can towns opt out of the trust fund? And what would be maybe some reasons they might want to do that?
They can opt out. We don't want anyone to opt out, to be honest with you, for a variety of reasons that we can discuss. The law does not allow a town to opt out until 1 year has lapsed from the effective date of the act. So that would be March 28th of 2020. So the 15 Cape towns are in the trust, and the surcharge applies to them between now and March 28th, 2020. Should they subsequently decide to get out of the trust, then they would no longer be able to benefit from the financial assistance that the trust provides. And so by withdrawing from the trust, a town would be taking whatever percentage of their wastewater costs that the trust would support and putting it back on their property tax base. Given the challenges that every municipality is facing and some of the pressure local taxpayers are under, I don't understand why you would proactively choose to impose an additional tax burden on your property tax owners to cover the cost of wastewater, a portion of which is needed to deal with the peak summer flows that the year-round population is not adding to.
Has anybody even suggested that at this point? I mean, it's pretty new. I mean, just passed in December. But what's been the reaction from the towns? I mean, you mentioned the board that's going to oversee all this. And there was, what, three towns already that have appointed somebody?
Yeah, Mashpee, Orleans, and Yarmouth.
Yeah. Do all the towns realize that they have to do this, that they have to appoint somebody, or is that still part of the learning process in all of this?
It's part of the learning process, but they'll be notified that they'll need to appoint a representative to the management board, and hopefully we'll be convening that board over the next few months.
Okay. All right, so...
Can I just jump in
one
other
point? Yeah, go ahead.
If a town takes money from the trust fund for a long-term assistance for a loan, once you take money, you can't leave until that financial obligation has been discharged. So in other words, towns can't sign on, get a 20-year principal forgiveness agreement from the trust fund, and then say, we're out. So there are some limitations on it.
Did the EPA set up a timeline for the Cape to reduce nitrogen pollution? And do we anticipate the Water Protection Trust Fund will grow large enough in that time period to help the towns afford the costs of all this wastewater management?
We report back to EPA somewhat regularly on progress that the communities are making. And so this is certainly an opportunity for us to highlight some of the significant financial benefits that this trust fund will allow the 15 communities. So we're hopeful that EPA and the Conservation Law Foundation will see this as a significant step forward in progress on the Cape.
So we don't have any kind of timeline at this point then?
Our next progress report is due to the EPA in April, and then we'll continue to provide them with updates on compliance with the communities.
I think the broader environmental community is keeping an eye on making sure that now that we have both a direction under the 208 plan and a significant external financing opportunity that was not available, even conceivable, frankly, when this whole process started, that towns are continuing to march forward. I think everybody accepts the fact that it took a long time to make this mess, and it's going to take a relatively long time to clean it up, but that progressive steps are being taken, and the towns are moving forward with their plans or working with their neighbors. And I think that the towns that choose now not to do some of those things are going to have to deal with some legal consequences.
You mentioned, Andrew, all these different types of projects that you can do, you know, dredging projects. You've got, you know, the aquaculture and all these different plans that you can implement. And towns are making these decisions. But the Cape Cod Commission, you assist towns with what's the best. How should I spend my money? Is this the right approach to whatever my water problems are? Talk a little bit about that, about how, because, you know, we might have a town going, you know, that's not going to be in your best interest. I mean, do you have those conversations?
We do. And we provide watershed team technical assistance to the communities upon their request. And our role in this management board is not only providing administrative support to the communities, but also technical support. So where communities might want additional assistance in putting together a watershed plan or a community outreach plan, that's where the commission staff can jump in and provide some of that assistance to the 15 communities. And really a lot of our expertise is working with groups of people and collaborating and making sure that communities are working together. So assisting with the community outreach, but also helping on the technical components of that, using some technology and putting together plans that can address the nitrogen problem.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, I'm going to go back to like thinking years ago when you weren't as optimistic maybe as you are now about solving this issue. Are you more optimistic?
Yes. I think, as I said, you know, years ago when we started this, we were arguing the basic fundamentals of the science and having people actually try and make the argument that our waterways weren't impaired. I think people have accepted that. And, you know, I think really right now it's a matter of the money. And, you know, over the 50-year implementation program of the 208 process, if you take the $20 million a year that we anticipate the trust fund providing, you know, it's not often that $1 billion in property tax relief is dropped on any region, let alone Cape Cod. And so with that significant a change in the fundamental discussion, it's hard not to feel optimistic. You know, now it's up to us to take advantage of the tools that the commission's provided that have made this all a lot more accessible and thoughtful and cheaper, and the money that the Commonwealth has unlocked through this trust fund to make it work.
Right. We'll have more information about the short-term rental tax and the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund at our website, capeandislands.org. Christy Senatore and Andrew Gottlieb, thanks so much for coming and explaining this complicated issue with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.